Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program number 737, Takiya Sunrise, Part 2, Turkish Taffy, Update on the Rolling Coups in the Middle East. This program is being recorded on March 20th of the year 2011. Happy spring, because we are now beginning springtime, although I can't say as I'm feeling all that springy these days. Things are looking pretty crazy, even aside from the horrible news coming out of Japan. In any event, this program is going to continue analysis of the admittedly complex and, as one listener constructively, critically observed, messy analysis of the piggyback coup, or what I call the piggyback coup in the Middle East. It really might be termed piggyback coups, plural. This is a very complex hypothesis that I've been developing. Really, it began with analysis of WikiLeaks and has proceeded from there. Please use the descriptions for the other broadcasts that I have recorded in this series. Also, increasingly, the archives will come in handy, not only the descriptions for the programs, but as this broadcast should illustrate, the books that are available for download for free in the books section. Now, in the past, I've referred to, and for example, in For the Record 735, I titled that program, The Bay of Pigs Meets the October Surprise. And that was an allusion to two covert ops, basically, one of which, of course, was the botched Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba in 1961. That was an operation that was actually begun under the Eisenhower administration. Richard Nixon, John F. Kennedy's opponent in the 1960 election, had much to do with overseeing the preparations for the Bay of Pigs, but that operation was carried over into JFK's term and appears to have been deliberately sabotaged, perhaps in order to force JFK's hand with an overt military operation against Cuba. Just such a thing, I believe, is happening vis-a-vis the piggyback coups in the Middle East. It alludes, the piggyback, by the way, alludes to not only the fact that the Tunisian coup appears to have inspired or sparked the Libyan coup, or the Egyptian coup, and perhaps others as well, but also to what I believe is going on, in which I think a naive and democratically with a small d oriented element of State Department and the intelligence community, and also the Obama administration, is basically helping with a covert operation that was begun under the Bush administration in the, I believe, naive hope or belief that simply allowing democratic free expression to Islamist elements in the Middle East will cause them to become more democratically oriented and to abandon their extremist and violent viewpoints. I certainly hope that turns out to be the case. I suspect that is wishful thinking, and I think that one of the things that's piggybacking is the underground Reich and the Bush/Karl Rove element of the intelligence community, who knows full well what the Muslim Brotherhood actually are all about and would not be at all unhappy to see them come to power in the Middle East with all that implies. That'll go certainly very badly for Israel. It'll go very badly for the United States, American troops in particular. And that ultimately, it will, however, go well for the underground Reich and for the transnational corporations that are inextricably linked with its operations. The Muslim Brotherhood is pro-business, one of the things that we've looked at in the past in this series, and that concerns the Ibn Khaldun Center for Development Studies at Cairo University, or at American University in Cairo. That university appears to have been one of the epicenters for the activism in Egypt. Certainly, Wael Ghanim, the Google marketing executive who assumed a prominent role, a highly visible role in that operation, was a marketing executive from Google. As I said, he also was a graduate of American University in Cairo. Saad el-Din Ibrahim was the head of the Ibn Khaldun Center for Development Studies at American University in Cairo. One of the people on his board is none other than Gamal al-Banna, the brother of Hassan al-Banna, founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. And again, Ibn Khaldun is the Muslim Brotherhood's number one economic theoretician. The World Bank views him as the first advocate of privatization. He could be thought of for our purposes here as the Muslim world's Milton Friedman, or the Islam's answer to Milton Friedman, or perhaps You might want to conceive of it, conceptualize it in this way. Ibn Khaldun is the dominant economic theoretician for the Muslim Brotherhood, and he held forth in the 14th century. The dominant economic theoretician for the American right, the Bush administration, Karl Rove et al., is Milton Friedman, who is the American 14th century economic theoretician. So we can think of Ibn Khaldun as basically the Milton Friedman of the Islamic world. Of course, his free market doctrine, his advocacy of privatization, is literally music to the ears of people like Grover Norquist and Karl Rove, and to the transnational corporate community. And I suspect that's one of the reasons why they won't be too unhappy to see the Muslim Brotherhood come to power. And if they turn out to be violent, well, what the heck? At least they're pro-business. I'm going to say more about the media coverage of this later on in the program. Now, another element in the title to For the Record 735, and that concerns the October Surprise. That is the name commonly given to an operation that was undertaken when Jimmy Carter was president in order to withhold the U.S. hostages that were taken from the U.S. Embassy in Tehran in November of 1979 until after Jimmy Carter's political humiliation and consequent defeat were assured. In some of our discussions with Farah Mansour, a member of the Iranian resistance, we have discussed Farah's research in which he indicated that the Shah of Iran in fact had cancer well before it had become publicly known, and that in fact this was known to the intelligence community and to Richard Helms in particular. And it is Farah's hypothesis, and by the way, an element of AFA 38, in which I interviewed Farah Mansour, is posted for convenience at the top of the page for the record, the description for the record 735. It was Farah's contention that, in fact, the West knew that the Shah had cancer well before that became public, and that the Khomeini forces and the mullahs, the mullocracy, so to speak, the Islamist theocracy that came to power in Iran, was deliberately installed by the West in order to assure that there would be a militantly anti-communist entity along the southern flank of the former Soviet Union. It was Farah's contention that what has become popularly known as the October Surprise was far more than a deal between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran. It was his contention that the actual seizing of the hostages as well as the grooming of the Khomeini forces themselves were part of a Western operation. Now, in that context, note the following. This is from the New York Times of Thursday, March 3rd of 2011, an article by Neil McFarquhar. It's headlined, "Paper in Egypt says Mubarak is at Saudi site receiving care." The question that suggests itself here is the extent to which something very similar happened in Egypt, because there's a report here that Hosni Mubarak, who's well into his 80s, is suffering from cancer and that he's being treated for that. If this is in fact the case, one must wonder if Mubarak's medical condition had become known to the forces in the West, the U.S. in particular, that created him as a political entity, and whether the time has come in the viewpoint of the corridors of power in the West to simply send him packing. His usefulness, I guess one could say, has been used up. In any event, the New York Times reports the following. Speculation that former President Hosni Mubarak had departed Egypt for Saudi Arabia heightened Wednesday, with a banner headline in a government-owned newspaper saying that he had left his villa in the Red Sea resort city of Sharm el-Sheikh. The newspaper, Al Akhbar, said that Mr. Mubarak and his immediate family had gone late last week to a special Saudi military complex at Tobruk, just across the Straits of Tehran, but inland, for chemotherapy treatment by his usual German doctors. He is suffering from pancreatic and colon cancer, it said. Rumors about Mr. Mubarak's whereabouts and health have been rife since he left the presidency on February 11th. So one wonders if, in fact, this account is accurate, and if, in fact, the now elderly Hosni Mubarak has cancer, one wonders to what extent the skids were being greased for him, just as they were for the Shah. Now, we're going to review some information that we've looked at in past broadcasts by way of shoring up this admittedly very complex and messy hypothesis. recall that in the latter part of, for the record, 736, we took a look at Gene Sharp, the nonviolent theoretician whose ideology was not only one of the principal tenets of the April 6th movement and of the young people who were mobilized in order to help bring down Hosni Mubarak, but also Gene Sharp's theories have played into the greasing of the skids, so to speak, for Milosevic, Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia. And interestingly, for our purposes here, also the POTAR movement in the Ukraine was heavily influenced by Gene Sharp. And that was a movement that initially was very supportive of Mr. Yushchenko in the Ukraine. They ultimately became one of Mr. Yushchenko's fiercest opponents. Recall that Mr. Yushchenko's wife, Ekaterina Chumachenko, by the way, the name of that organization is PORA, P-O-R-A, that Ekaterina Chumachenko, the point person for the OUNB, the Ukrainian fascists, that evolved from the Bandera group, well, she was the first lady. She became the first lady of the Ukraine. Ultimately, Stefan Bandera was named the hero of the Ukraine just before Mr. Yushchenko left power. One of the questions I think we need to ask ourselves is whether perhaps the Jasmine coup in Tunisia, or whatever you want to call it, in Egypt, ultimately leads to something not unlike what it led to in the Ukraine for a time, bringing some arch-reactionaries and fascists back into power and favor. We're going to take a closer look now at Gene Sharp. This from an article from February 16th of 2011. We went into this in 736. Shy U.S. intellectual created playbook used in a revolution. It's by Cheryl Gay Stolberg. It reads in part, when the nonpartisan International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, which trains democracy activists, slipped into Cairo several years ago to conduct a workshop, among the papers it distributed was Mr. Sharp's 198 Methods of Nonviolent Action, a list of tactics that range from hunger strikes to protest disrobing to disclosing identities of secret agents. Dalia Ziada, an Egyptian blogger and activist who attended the workshop and later organized similar sessions on her own, said trainees were active in both the Tunisia and Egypt revolts. She said that some activists translated excerpts of Mr. Sharp's work into Arabic and that his message of attacking weaknesses of dictators, unquote, stuck with them. Peter Ackerman, a one-time student of Mr. Sharp, who founded the Nonviolent Center and ran the Cairo workshop, cites his former mentor as proof that, quote, ideas have power, unquote. Note Mr. Peter Ackerman here, because his sponsorship, his underwriting of Mr. Sharp is critical here. And as we're going to take a look, there's far more to Peter Ackerman and Gene Sharp than meets the eye, at least from this initial description. Continuing with the New York Times article, Mr. Sharp, hard-nosed yet exceedingly shy, is careful not to take credit. He is more thinker than revolutionary. Though as a young man, he participated in lunch counter sit-ins and spent 9 months at a federal prison in Danbury, Connecticut, as a conscientious objector during the Korean War. He has had no contact with the Egyptian protesters, he said, although he recently learned that the Muslim Brotherhood had From Dictatorship to Democracy posted on its website. Mr. Ackerman, who became wealthy as an investment banker after studying under Mr. Sharp, contributed millions of dollars and kept it afloat for years. But about a decade ago, Mr. Ackerman wanted to disseminate Mr. Sharp's ideas more aggressively as well as his own. He put his money into his own center, which also produces movies and even a video game to train dissidents. An annuity he purchased still helps to pay Mr. Sharp's salary. So Gene Sharp, again, one of the major theoreticians involved in the Tunisian and Egyptian uprisings, financed and underwritten in considerable measure by Peter Ackerman. We're going to take a closer look at these individuals and the forces that have shaped them, because it certainly looks wonderful. And indeed, I don't want to be misunderstood as being a little too much of a curmudgeon. Certainly the images that we saw coming out of Tahrir Square were very inspiring. It looked wonderful. But an image is just that. It's an image, and it doesn't necessarily have any substance to it. We're going to take a look at some of Gene Sharp's profile. This from his Wikipedia page. Wikipedia, as I've said in the past, must be used carefully. Check the links out, and if there are any problems with those, be careful. But in this case, the links check out. And interestingly, in Gene Sharp's CV, we find the following. Sharp has been a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, since 1972. He simultaneously held research appointments at Harvard University's Center for International Affairs since 1965. Again, holding a number of research appointments at Harvard University's Center for International Affairs while working as a professor at University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth. Interestingly enough, the Center for International Studies, for International Affairs at Harvard, was founded by Robert R. Bowie. Now, Robert R. Bowie was deputy director of CIA from 1977 to 79. That, by the way, is when some of the October surprise-related activities were gathering steam. Before that, Robert R. Bowie was a trusted confidant, as it says here from Robert R. Bowie's Wikipedia page. It says here he was the co-founder of Harvard Center for International Affairs. That is the institution at which Gene Sharp has held a number of appointments. Interestingly, about Robert R. Bowie's background, in addition to deputy director of CIA from 77 to 79, the youngest professor at Harvard University, he was a trusted confidant to John J. McCloy, the unofficial chairman of the American establishment, unquote. During periods of leave from Harvard between 1950 and 1952, Bowie worked for McCloy as one of his legal advisors in Germany. That was when the whole Nazi recrudescence was being basically hammered together by Frank Wisner and people in the State Department. So again, when we take a look at Gene Sharp and the Harvard Center for International Affairs, we begin to find elements and individuals that are from the mainstream of American power structure, which really should not come as any great surprise. Now, note that Gene Sharp, the wonderful groovy nonviolent activist, has been underwritten in considerable measure by a fellow named Peter Ackerman. We're going to go into Peter Ackerman's background right now, again from his Wikipedia page and the links do check out. Peter Ackerman was born in New York City, November 6, 1946, and educated at Colgate University and the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, where he earned a Ph.D. in international relations. By the way, he's still very much involved with Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, virtually an extension of the U.S. State Department. Now, more about Peter Ackerman, who's the fellow who's been underwriting Gene Sharp, the primary nonviolent theoretician behind the uprisings in Egypt and Tunisia. Of Peter Ackerman, after his graduation, he joined the junk bond dealers Drexel, Burnham, Lambert, and for most of the next 15 years, he was the right-hand man to Michael Milken, the junk bond king. He became the key dealmaker and strategist for the company, and his innovative approach to dealmaking, together with his unusual academic qualifications, earned him the nickname the absent-minded professor, unquote. But the record shows that he was far from absent-minded. And more about some of the institutional affiliations and activities of Peter Ackerman. Peter Ackerman was on the advisory board of the United States Institute of Peace. We're going to talk about that in just a second. But he also is on the executive council of the Cato Institute. And the advisory board, I should say, of the Cato Institute. He also has been a member of the advisory board of Freedom House as well. Now, recall that in For the Record Program 725, Wiki Spooks, or Leak This, Wiki Spooks in the World of Stieg Larsson, we took a look at WikiLeaks founder and now dissident John Young's assessment of WikiLeaks. He released a bunch of emails, that he got from Julian Assange, in which Julian Assange discussed, among other things, having had contacts with Freedom House and other elements of CIA, including CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, which is very close to CIA. Julian Assange referred to these as CIA, quote, teats, unquote, T-E-A-T-S, and indicated that, well, if we need to get money from these groups to do what we want to do, then we'll get money from them. Interesting that Freedom House, often, by the way, criticized by the Cato Institute, on whose board Peter Ackerman sits, Peter Ackerman was very deeply involved with Freedom House in the past. And Freedom House, as well as CFR, on whose advisory board Peter Ackerman sits, also among the institutions that apparently had, quote, pullbacks, unquote, from the basically from, but had pullbacks with WikiLeaks. And note that Peter Ackerman continues to be deeply involved with the Fletcher Institute of the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University. So again, with Peter Ackerman, you're talking Michael Milken's right-hand man, you're talking Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank founded by the Koch brothers, you're talking Freedom House, you're talking Council on Foreign Relations. This is somebody who is connected not only to the corridors of power, but as we take a look at the fact that the American Embassy in Cairo was meeting both with members of Muslim Brotherhood and with members of the April 6th movement while George Bush was still in office. And when we take a look at the Ibn Khaldun philosophy, Ibn Khaldun, again, the Milton Friedman of the Muslim world, and when we take a look at who is helping to pay the bills here for the operations of Gene Sharp, I think the free market philosophy of Ibn Khaldun, the free market philosophy espoused by the Muslim Brotherhood, begins to come into focus here. Certainly, the Michael Milkins of the world and the Peter Ackermans of the world would be very well disposed toward free market ideology and privatization. And so the likes of Ibn Khaldun and others are not at all displeasing to people like Peter Ackerman and Michael Milken, I don't know if you'd call him his mentor, but his longtime collaborator. Now, in some of the past programs about this subject, such as For the Record 735, we have spoken about the United States Institute of Peace. Now, from SourceWatch, we talk about the United States Institute of Peace. The United States Institute of Peace is, to quote the institution's website, an independent, nonpartisan federal institution created and funded by Congress to strengthen the nation's capacity to promote the peaceful resolution of international conflict. In 1981, a congressionally chartered commission recommended the creation of a national peace academy. The United States Institute of Peace was signed into law in 1984 by President Ronald Reagan. Established in 1984, the Institute meets its congressional mandate through an array of programs including grants, fellowships, conferences, and workshops, library services, publications, and other educational activities. The Institute's Board of Directors is appointed by the President of the United States and confirmed by the Senate. One of the members of the U.S. Advisory Council of the United States Institute of Peace, Peter Ackerman, underwriter and financier of Gene Sharp's activities, right-hand man of Michael Milken, the junk bond king, and also somebody very close to CFR, very close to Freedom House, and also on the board of the Cato Institute, the libertarian think tank funded by the Koch brothers. Noting, again, among the influences that Gene Sharp has had, he was one of the main influences on the PORA organization that had much to do with the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine. The Ukrainian autocrats were cast out in favor of Mr. Yushchenko, who it turned out was not exactly a day at the beach. Mr. Yushchenko's wife, as we've looked at in For the Record 529, was the former Ekaterina Chumachenko in charge of presidential liaison under Ronald Reagan, thereby fitting into the series of appointments that were scheduled for Ronald Reagan by Helena von Dahm, the protege of Otto von Bolschwing, the SS officer who was Eichmann's superior in administering, quote, Jewish policy for the SS under Hitler. And again, after Vladimir Yushchenko, after Mr. Yushchenko became president, and after his regime turned out to be less than redemptive, shall we say, PORA turned against Yushchenko shortly before leaving office. Mr. Yushchenko named Stefan Bandera the ideological hero of the OUNB that was headed up by his wife as a hero of the Ukraine. The Kiev Ukraine news blog has an article about the PORA turning against Yushchenko. From September 28th of 2005, Dateline Kiev in the Ukraine, Diaspora, the non-governmental organization that played a decisive role in Ukraine's Orange Revolution, has adopted a highly critical stance towards the 10-point memorandum signed last week by President Viktor Yushchenko and the leader of the Party of Regions, former Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych. Ultimately, Kpora, again, inspired in considerable measure in using the theories of Gene Sharp and one of the main elements in the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine, they turned against Mr. Yushchenko. One of the questions, I think, is that whether or not people in the April 6th movement, some of the folks who've assisted them, such as some of the Pirate Bay and anonymous people, again, anything but fascists, people who might be characterized as anarcho-utopian, but just as the Pora people appear to have been very cynically used in order to put in basically the OUNB, one has to wonder whether the Pirate Vortex folks, the April 6th people, and others have been very, very cynically used in order to put the Muslim Brotherhood ultimately in power with their free market ideology. Again, this remains to be seen. Now, what we're going to do next is to take a look at some of the history. Why? How could such a thing take place? And I think a synopsis introducing one major element of discussion was presented by Ian Johnson, the author of A Mosque in Munich, that was the focal point of For the Record 721. In the New York Review of Books, Ian Johnson had an article, Washington's Secret History with the Muslim Brotherhood. And this is from the New York Review of Books, February 5th of 2011. And in this, we find the following. In the years after the September 11th attacks, the United States initially went after the Muslim Brotherhood, declaring many of its key members to be backers of terrorism. But by Bush's second term, the U.S. was losing two wars in the Muslim world and facing hostile Muslim minorities in Germany, France, and other European countries where the Brotherhood had established an influential presence. The U.S. quietly changed its position. This is under the Bush administration. Continuing, the Bush administration devised a strategy to establish close relations with Muslims in Europe that were ideologically close to the Brotherhood, figuring that it could be an interlocutor in dealing with more radical groups such as the homegrown extremists in Paris, London, and Hamburg. And as in the 1950s, government officials wanted to project an image to the Muslim world that Washington was close to Western-based Islamists. So starting in 2005, the State Department launched an effort to woo the Brotherhood. In 2006, for example, it organized a conference in Brussels between these European Muslim brothers and American Muslims, such as the Islamic Society of North America, who were considered close to the Muslim Brotherhood. All of this was backed by CIA analyses, with one from 2006 saying the Brotherhood featured, quote, impressive internal dynamism, organization, and media savvy, unquote. Despite the concerns of Western allies that supporting the Brotherhood in Europe was too risky, the CIA pushed for cooperation. As for the Obama administration, it carried over some of the people on the Bush team who had helped devise this strategy in the first place. And this goes to one of the, what I believe is one of the major dynamics of what we're seeing in the Middle East. It's one of the reasons I'm calling it a piggyback coup, because basically an operation that was begun under the Bush administration has been carried over into the Obama administration, and I believe that Obama is basically going to be bad-jacketed for a whole bunch of things, including, quote, losing the Middle East, unquote, and he could take a huge hit if there's a major terrorist incident such as the utilization of WMDs that arises out of this. Well, we're going to take a look inside, too, is basically Karl Rove and Grover Norquist and their collaboration with the Muslim Brotherhood, and they're forging a very strong Muslim Brotherhood link with the Republican Party itself, as opposed to the Bush administration proper. However, that is in Side 2, because this concludes Side 1, Takiya Sunrise, Part 2, Turkish Taffy. More on the rolling coups in the Middle East. This program is being recorded on March 20th of the year 2011. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.